Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 1st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. In the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Guess what, folks? Today's not live. I know I may have implied at certain times over the past week that today would be live. Tomorrow will definitely be live. Today, not so much. Well, maybe then I should turn off my iPad. I'm not going to listen to this. Why should I bother? I'll tell you why you should bother. Because today I do a great interview with David Bromwich. He is a teacher of literature and political writing at Yale University. That's right, Yale in New Haven. And he also writes at the Huffington Post and the New York Review of Books, Tom Dispatch as well. And he had a great piece about just the advisors that President Obama has chosen to keep around him and those that he has jettisoned. And his argument is this provides us insight into the reality of the Obama administration. So, folks, enjoy this interview today. It's a good one. And remember, you would never hear interviews like this ever if it wasn't for the members of this show who pay 33 cents a day to keep this show alive. But sadly, we need more of you to do it. Otherwise, the show can't be kept alive. That's the nature of a listener-supported show. On one hand, you get interviews from guys like David Bromwich, who you would never hear from, certainly not for 30 minutes, on TV or radio. I don't care what kind of radio it is. On the other hand, there's a little bit of good, there's a little bit of bad. The bad part is you got to pay for it if you want it to continue. It's been almost a year now, folks, so it's time to pony up. All right, folks, many other ways you can support us. Check out majority.fm. Otherwise, enjoy this. I will definitely be back live tomorrow, and hope you're having a good one. On the phone with me is David Bromwich. He teaches literature at Yale University, and he is, of course, a regular at the Huffington Post and the New York Review of Books, as well as a regular at Tom Dispatch. David, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
All right, so let's talk about your piece, the symptoms of the Bush-Obama presidency. You quoted William James in the piece, and it really, as someone who has spent a lot of time, and fortunately I think I'm past this now, trying to infer what is in President Obama's heart and mind, this quote from William James, "By their fruits shall ye know them, not by their roots," has sort of emancipated me from that search. What do you mean by that?
Well, it's as applied to this case, the case of Obama as president, I suppose it's just another way of saying judge him by his actions, not by his words, and not by his origins, what his earlier politics seemed to be.
And you took this opportunity to basically apply that judgment in terms of his actions to those he's surrounded himself with. I mean, many people have referred to his financial team, essentially the economists he surrounded himself with, his financial advisors, as basically the original sin. And you've outlined those advisors that he's kept or saved, and those that he has not. Let's go through those, shall we?
Sure. And this is just a selection, and because of my incompetence, it is not heavy on the financial advisors, but distributes the personalities over different fields.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I've made almost a living on incompetence in many fields, but let's start with Lawrence Summers. He makes the top of your list.
Yeah, well, Summers, when he was in the Clinton administration, was essential in getting the Glass-Steagall Act repealed, and that's the law regulating banks that kept commercial banks, such as people like you and me use, separate from the big money firms, the brokerage houses, and so on. And once that was down, the way was open for complex derivatives, for the subprime mortgages being farmed out into many different and almost incomprehensible instruments, which was a large part in the financial collapse of 2008-2009. So, Summers is, I would say, one of the moderate, actually not one of the very most extreme representatives of the view that the heart of the economy is Wall Street, and the heart of Wall Street is Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, and so on. These firms that have to stay alive, even if it takes, living by constant transfusion of taxpayer dollars. So that's not a view one would have identified with Obama at all until he laid out his team of economic advisors, and I think it was June 2008. But it turns out to have been part of his orientation going pretty far back, including, the preponderance of his closest associates at Harvard Law School. So, there's a case of somebody very much of the establishment, but not in any way likely to help us reorganize a system that had gone wrong in 2008, being chosen for a role of extremely important influence.
I mean, do you think that, and again, it's impossible to second guess, and I guess this is sort of contrary to know by the fruits. I mean, when you have someone like Summers, and at one point I think it looked like even Rubin was going to be part of this cadre, but he was sort of embroiled in a
They're all they're all Rubinists. I mean, after all, Geithner was involved in a small scandal about paying his income taxes, but Obama, being advised how important he was to people like Hank Paulson, the previous Treasury Secretary, and I'm guessing that he was a top choice for Summers, too. All these people liked how cooperative Geithner had been at the New York Fed with the desires, the immediate emergency needs of the banks and money firms. So, I mean, being in a little bit of scandal trouble was no impediment to Obama appointing someone if he liked them. I think that the case of Rubin is he's an enormously powerful worker behind the scenes, and all his actors were in place anyway. So, I mean, But that's their philosophy. What I suppose relatively uninformed people like me, at least on these issues, would have expected is that there would be anyhow some mix of, Keynesian, liberal, popular economists, by which I mean representing the interests of the people more than the banks, people like Krugman and people like
Stiglitz right.
And people like even, Simon Johnson and Nouriel Roubini and people less orthodox than Summers and Geithner who had been more right about 2008. But they were not allowed in. It was a pure, Wall Street team.
So let's move on from the financial advisors to number two on your list, which, gave, I guess, he at times actually seemed to try and pull in the reins a little bit, but it's Robert Gates.
Yeah, Robert Gates seems to have been a personality very you know, harmonious with Obama in the sense of being low-key and a bureaucratic inside worker, not liking drama and not even in a way knowing how to handle drama. So it is said that they got along well, and, you know, I suppose we can thank Gates, perhaps, for the fact that the United States never bombed Syria or Iran in 2007 as people around Dick Cheney wanted us to. Gates, you know, sort of muffled the war aims of the Bush presidency in its second term. But an odd choice for somebody who wants to register a real change of course, and for Obama to broadcast, as he did, that he would like Gates to stay on as long as possible. You would have thought that somebody interested in drawing back from American force projection in the Arab world, reassuring, you know, that part of international opinion and people that the United States was not making war on Islam, that a president interested in all that, as Obama claimed to be, might appoint somebody more unorthodox and really different, somebody like even Chuck Hagel, if he wanted a bipartisan cabinet. Chuck Hagel was an opponent of the Iraq War and had helped Obama enormously in the campaign by accompanying him on his trip to visit the troops in Europe and elsewhere. So, I mean, there's a possible turn that had not been made. He just stuck with Gates, and now he's got Panetta, Leon Panetta, in that role, who has no particular competence in defense at all and will keep things going much as they are.
Let's move to Rahm Emanuel, who is probably his appointment probably signaled was just that incredibly glaring red flag, I think, particularly for liberals and progressives.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was politically a red flag. I don't see Rahm Emanuel as an ideological type at all, but it showed that Obama wanted somebody else to be in there with bare hands and doing the work, that Obama himself wasn't going to be very engaged in bargaining and in negotiations. But it's true that Emanuel in 2006 made a policy of weeding out the anti-war Democrats from the party slate, which Emanuel was responsible for putting together. And he seems to have been behind getting rid of the forces within the administration who wanted to close Guantanamo. It was just seen as politically not possible. And once it's politically not possible, a man like Emanuel is going to push the other way.
And Cass Sunstein, you put on this list, and he is one of those that I think from my perspective, I think was one that people didn't quite know what to make of him because at various times, I mean, I guess coming out of the Bush administration, there were a lot of voices who were very prominently speaking out against the Bush administration on all sorts of issues, and I think Cass Sunstein was one of them. But it sort of belied his sort of deeper relationship with corporatism, I think maybe is the best way to put it.
Yeah, Sunstein is someone who advises liberals to win their battles given the means within American popular opinion, which means agreeing that we are a culture of business and not of regulation. Obama put him into a very important regulative position, and one of the links that I used in that article to a long research piece by Dan Frumkin, which was in the Huffington Post, talks about the extent to which, as a regulative chief, Sunstein is not regulating. He's also, to put it as mildly as possible, no libertarian. He is not a strong defender of civil liberties against encroachments from, for example, the Patriot Act, and he seems to have had a part in persuading Obama against his campaign promise to filibuster amnesty for the telecoms that did, you know, data mining on American citizens. This was back in 2008. But it was, you know, in that respect, a lot of Sunstein's positions are consonant with letting the Bush machine go forward. He's a moderate of some sort, but it's an odd choice, again, if you're talking about regulation.
And finally, let's talk about Eric Holder, who, to my mind, has been completely, I mean, beyond, he's been complicit, I think, in much of what the banks have been able to get away with and continue to get away with. The latest story, of course, is the pressure that is supposedly coming from the Department of Justice as well as HUD upon Eric Schneiderman to sort of get with the program and
yep.
give immunity to the banks for what would be a pittance in terms of their mortgage skullduggery, if you will.
Yeah, skullduggery, swindling, whatever you want to call it. It's enough to say about him that there has not been one prosecution of a major actor, either from one of the banks or from the financial houses, in the collapse of 2008. Not one major prosecution, and it is widely supposed that there never will be one. On the other hand, he has mounted a campaign against government whistleblowers in excess of what any previous administration has done. And I think this is an effort by Obama and the people around him to show that he can be tougher on national security than the Republicans. And it's a terrible pitfall for Democrats. It has been all through my lifetime. It's going back to Truman and Joseph McCarthy to get to the right-wing positions before the right does, to purge the government of all people who have the taint of communist associations, even before the House and American Activities Committee can get to them. And so in this case, to outdo what Bush would have done in actually going back to an old and antiquated and barbarous law, the Foreign Intelligence, the Espionage Act of 1917, which had hardly ever been used and is now being used against whistleblowers. So, I mean, I would take that and Obama's expansion of the Afghanistan war as examples of a typical and very unhappy syndrome of Democrats when they get into power, which is to say we have to outdo the Republicans in war and security, otherwise they'll win the next election.
Let me ask you about the former. I mean, my recollection is that Obama did actually campaign on expanding the Afghanistan theater, but that aside, from a political...
You're not wrong. I mean, Obama... Yeah, I think that was a rhetorical trap that he made for himself, but if you
right.
remember... How it happened was Hillary Clinton had her vote for the Iraq war to support, so she said she didn't think the Iraq war was wrong, even though it was done wrong, a sort of standard middle-of-the-road Democratic Party position at that time. And Obama said, no, Iraq was a dumb war. He never made any kind of moral or deeper principled condemnation of it. But it was a dumb war because it couldn't be won. The evidence wasn't good enough. He halfway backed off that, too, by the general election. But he then had to commit himself to something to offset that seemingly radical position. He said, Afghanistan is the war we're really in.
Right.
We're losing it. I think he believed it would be a short-term investment, that, 10,000-20,000 more troops, as we're already being ordered, to, plug up the holes in Afghanistan, and we could negotiate some sort of peace. But, of course, Afghanistan is really about Pakistan, as we are coming to know. And the investment in war on that front is going to be major and not going to cease, no matter what kind of accommodation they can work out on Afghanistan. And Obama hasn't shown any real appetite for explaining his reasons clearly to the American people. He talks about Al-Qaeda, but he does not talk about Kashmir, about the rivalry between Pakistan and India, about Pakistan as a nuclear power. These might even be good reasons. But anyway, he floats along with the old consensus, but throws in more troops. So I think you're right that he had said Afghanistan is the war that counts. But I don't think anybody could have expected he would have more than doubled our troop commitment,
right.
and that we'd all be thinking it's still going to go forward in 2015.
Well, and I think the notion of the electorate. Or the notion that in Democratic circles that the electorate needs to see Democrats as strong on defense, I can see it in that example in terms of the reasons behind that. At least on a political level, let me put it this way: I can understand and am aware of the calculus.
Yeah,
but
the political calculation.
But
right.
when we talk about the whistleblowing. There's no one. I mean, I honestly believe that you could not find more than 1%, if that, of the American public who would know the name of, let's say, Thomas Drake, for instance.
Right, about whom Jane Mayer wrote an article about his prosecution.
Yes, yeah. He was the NSA whistleblower who was really just whistleblowing, I mean, ultimately, on just the incredible inefficiency of the NSA in their spying on some level. And the vigor in which the Obama administration pursued them. I mean,
That was, I believe, a prosecution initiated under the Gonzalez and then Mukasey Bush Justice Department. But Obama's people persisted in it with extraordinary ferocity. That no one would have expected. That was one they could have called off if they wanted to. But there, perhaps the calculation is, you know, many people telling this president, look, as is said on the news all the time, there's a chance this country will be hit again by an attack, not just an underwear bomber or these things that fizzle, but something bigger. What you've got to do is everything possible, most visible in every department, to show that you are working against that possibility. And that means, you know, lots of drones, warfare in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and it means lots of prosecutions within the U.S. And at that point, I think political calculation has changed the character of the actor, and Obama is somebody he couldn't recognize if he looked at himself from 2007 forward to 2011.
So a move like that is more about inoculating yourself from potential future political liability than it is anything that would be a liability absent any future problem.
Well, yeah, you can say that it's just guarding himself, but once you set these precedents of prosecutions of a certain sort, just as once you set the precedent of intervention without the permission of Congress in a war like Libya, however well-intentioned,
right,
these are precedents that become part of people's political habits, and it seems more normal to do them again. And that, I think, is where Obama has been most disappointing, that he has not wanted to turn us around, to use the phrase he often did, but to just keep going in the same direction until a chance comes to start very slowly turning one or two things around.
Do you think, and not to belabor this point, but do you think that something like Drake also has to do with that there is another constituency that he is dealing with there? I mean, not just the sense of perception of Democrats in terms of defense and security, but that he has less assuredness in dealing with the security and defense apparatus of the nation.
Yeah, sure, there is that. That was said about Clinton, too, and you might remember the confrontation between Jesse Helms and Clinton when Helms said that Clinton was not safe at any army base, and Clinton did not respond very strongly. But there, I would say, what we're seeing is a sign of weakness, of lack of political courage. Obama was outflanked and overwhelmed pretty early by the attacks that came from Dick Cheney and Liz Cheney and a lot of people in that corner, which caused him to give his May 2009 National Archives speech saying that some of these prisoners at Guantanamo would stay there forever, and that there would be different categories of prisoners, but he was committed to the old security policy. I think that Cheney backed Obama down, and I think we're where that has left us, that Cheney is a person of enormous strength, nerve, and determination, and Obama is a person, it turns out, of good intentions, but much weaker determination, much weaker political character. So what we see, I mean, some people say, oh, no, he's a stalking horse for the conservatives. He really wanted more wars. He really wanted to institute repression from the nationals. I don't think so. Why would he have said the opposite if he wanted to do that? It only exposes him to attack from two fronts. But it seems he wanted one thing, but was really far too weak and ill-equipped and ill-prepared as a national leader, either to institute a different policy or to know how to explain it well.
All right, and let's talk, I mean, briefly, we don't have too much time left, but you list a number of people who were sacked, who, by the fact that they were sacked, also sort of further explain, essentially, if not what's in his heart, but what makes up his actions as president. Who Who of this list do you think are the most indicative and most important that he did not either support as they were seeking a nomination, like speaking specifically
Cartwright.
Of Cartwright or Don Johnson, let's say? Who do you think are most exemplary?
Well, let's take two different categories. In the category of military advisors who supported Obama's very broad intention of pulling back from aggressive force projection and wars in the Arab world, he had on his side the Marine General Jim Jones, his first national security advisor, and he had James Cartwright, whose name was floated as the new chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Obama, you know, thought those were good people, would have liked to follow their advice, apparently, but he ended up following Petraeus, McChrystal, and the consensus of other generals. Now, that's a very hard thing to do, to go against military people if you are non-military in your personal history, or if you're any kind of American president. But the point there is, as one can learn from Woodward's book and other sources, Obama had a lot of generals, a lot of top military brass on his side if he wanted to pull with people like Jones and Cartwright, and he did not. Don Johnson and Carol Browner are cases of, and maybe much more, Greg Craig, are people who were trying to undo the Bush-Cheney policies as an aberration. Don Johnson wrote against the torture memos.
We should say Don Johnson was...
she was his nominee for the...
Office of Legal Counsel.
The Office of Legal Counsel, which gives advice on the legality or illegality of contemplated actions by the executive and by the Justice Department itself. She had to have her nomination wait 14 months without much backing from the White House until finally, with ill grace, they just withdrew it. And I believe that is what they did to Elizabeth Warren, too. So that's the pattern. When you have people who are associated with what had been assumed to be Obama's politics 2, 3, 4 years ago, their names are still up there. There is an effort made of some sort to have them in the administration. But once there's resistance encountered, Obama pulls back and scuttles them. And I think that's been a terrible history because it shows that he is intimidated. And it keeps strong voices of a different kind out of the administration. This president has constantly said, I need a movement, a popular movement to support me, then I'll do what I really want to do. But you can't even have a popular movement if the whole middle layer is ring after ring of people who are conformists to the earlier policies. And that's what he stocked himself with. And I think it's been a self-defeating posture.
I'd add, too, that for someone who has sought, you know, outside support for his programs during his campaign, probably as late as the summer of 2008, he was his campaign was specifically saying to donors, "Do not give money to outside groups, because we don't want that type of competition for our agenda."
Yes, that has been a terrible side effect of the success of Obama for America, Pluff's campaign for Obama in 2008, that they sucked the oxygen out of all the other movements. And now, if the president really wanted a movement, well, he has labor and he hasn't done much about it in Wisconsin, but if he wanted other political movements, an anti-war movement, for example, to support his intentions, which thus far haven't appeared strongly in action, their resources are weaker now, because he asked us to count on him and then appointed people who would not help him to do what he said he wanted to do. So that's the posture, and I think bad luck for us all, because, of course, on the other side, you have people so unimaginably worse that they are no kind of intelligent opposition.
I mean, that is the most definitely, I think, the political equation, too, that the Obama White House is making in terms of 2012.
Yep.
Well, that's a good place to end it.
I think we've stopped.
Exactly. Well, David, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Of course, you can check David's writing out at the Huffington Post or Tom Dispatch or in the New York Review of Books or in the Yale Review. David,
good talking
thank you
to
very
you.
Much.
Feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.